This is Hazel Kahn, and you're tuned to Northfolk Works, where each month I ask one of my interesting, unusual neighbors to tell me how they live and work out here on the North Fork of Long Island. My guest today is Robin Epperson McCarthy, who's going to tell us how her academic training brought her to become a sommelier, and this year to become a brand new winemaker. Robin, you're the first sommelier I've ever talked to, and I'm delighted to welcome you to Northfolk Works and to WPKN. I'm not sure, though, whether you are a Northfolk native, born out here or not. Are you?
I am not a Northfolk native because I was born actually down in Fort White, Florida. My parents were both artists that had relocated down there, so they met down there.
This is where you grew up then, in essence,
yes.
And where you went to school.
Yeah, and I have family in the area, so we've got strong ties to the community. Yeah.
And you went to Mattituck High School, I read somewhere.
Correct, yep.
What about college? What did you do about college?
I went to the University of Mary Washington, which was down in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and got a degree. I was on a pre-med track, so I have a degree in biology with a minor in chemistry, which is kind of what led me into the wine industry.
Really?
Graduated there with the major in biology, minor in chemistry. Signed up for the Peace Corps, which I didn't end up going to because they kept giving me assignments that had nothing to do with medicine. And Mom had a really good work ethic, and I was not allowed to live at home for free, so I had to get a job and pay rent. So I ended up in a roundabout way through the sailing community at Premium Wine Group as a temporary
assistant.
I was their lab assistant for the harvest of 2003. I got hired in October, which is the peak of their harvest season, and really, it was christening by fire there. I was thrown into it, and I had the science background to know, you know, how to run the lab equipment and be repetitive and consistent in my work, but I didn't know why we were doing this stuff until, thankfully, one of the great things about Premium Wine Group was that I was working with 12 different winemakers, one of which was Gilles Martin, who took the time to explain to me, make those bridges between the chemistry and the winemaking and how that science and art, the enology, came together.
Yeah, it's sort of odd to me that you came to wine really through science.
Yeah. Well, it was an easy transfer. There are many, many, many books written about winemaking. It's a very old science, and Russell Hearn had a great library at Premium Wine Group, and I basically made a point of borrowing the books and reading them, and there were a couple of books that were all, you know, biology and chemistry, so I knew the language. I could read science.
Do most people here who work in the wine industry know all that stuff?
They need to have an understanding of it, but enology is a science and an art, so we're seeing a movement right now to very hands-off winemaking practices where they're not necessarily looking at the minutiae of the chemistry. They're trying to keep the wine as true to the vineyard as possible. So minimal adjustments. Yeah, you don't want to make too many additions to it. You just don't want to manipulate it too much. You want to let it do its own thing and be as wild as possible. It's just a different philosophy, a different approach to winemaking. A lot of people were doing it anyway. Now there's more of a conscious approach to just use the indigenous yeast that naturally live on the grapes and maybe not do crushing and destemming, just letting it go through with reds like whole cluster fermentation. I think it just has a lot to do with a lot of people going back to, you know, buying local produce, trying to source as locally as possible, embracing what we naturally are given by our environment. So, you know, one of the things that we are given is yeast on the grape, so we can utilize that. I think everybody's trying to make the best wine that they can make, and some people are trying to do something different, because if you have everybody making wine the exact same way, then what's the point?
Right.
Then you just get down to pretty bottles and fancy labels. It's just, I think it's more just different approaches, different personal ideals. Well, hands-off is basically, you know, bringing in clean fruit and putting it in a bin and letting whatever will happen, happen. Having a little bit more control over that is maybe looking at the levels, looking at the acid, looking at the sugar, and having an idea of what you've made in the past or where you want the wine to go. And I wouldn't accuse anybody out here of being really manipulative. Most people are very true. I mean, we're blessed with a region where we get beautiful fruit. That you don't have to do that. You know, I've worked in other places where they do manipulate a lot. When I was out on the West Coast, there was, you know, a little bit of manipulation that went on that. But, you know, if that's what you have to do to make a good product, then, you know, what's the point?
Working here at the Premium Wines, was that the first job you had out of college?
No, actually the first job I had was working for Suffolk County with the Piping Plover Endangered Species Project. That was all through Suffolk County. Suffolk County Parks actually has a pretty phenomenal parks program. Unfortunately, they just don't have the funding to do a lot of the projects they wanted. The winter of 2005, I ended up going to New Zealand to work the harvest there, and I worked for a flavor chemist there who became a winemaker, and he really connected the dots for me of how to put this biology and chemistry into aromatic flavor, you know. Mm. And like I said, we weren't manipulating anything. It was just understanding it and what was going on there. Because he specialized in Rieslings and Gewürztraminers. So he spent a lot of time looking at different yeast strain selections, different fermentation temperatures, fermentation times, stuff like that, to see what they would produce aroma-wise. He was fantastic to work for, and I actually went back a few years ago. And so I was there for about 3.5 months, and then came back here to work the 2005 vintage here. Went back, actually, to Tasmania in 2006 to a place called Bay of Fires Winery. I was hired as the night enologist, so I ran their wine lab at night. They ran 24 hours a day during harvest, so we had 2 12-hour shifts. So it was an intense 3 months.
And then?
And then I came back again. Harvest 2006 here. I was here all of 2007. That's when I got my first certification with the Sommelier Society of America.
Was that a natural path to go from this all this lab stuff to being a sommelier?
No, I decided to get my training as a sommelier because, you know, I had this really strong understanding of wine from the science part of it, and I didn't really know a lot about global wines. You know, I remember being at a harvest dinner and they brought out like a Premier Cru, and I was like, well, what's a Premier Cru? And they all kind of looked at me like, how do you know this much about wine and not know that? So I took the SSA course as a way to like kind of fill in those gaps. And actually, I did that during the 2007 harvest, which in hindsight, I don't know how I did that, but I did. You know, I was working 12, 13-hour days at the winery 6 days a week. I had one day off, and that was the day I was in classes down on the South Fork.
The sommelier classes.
Yeah, yeah. I was running the lab at Premium.
Oh, it was always the lab. Yeah, you were never out in the fields or sort of picking grapes or anything.
No, but I have done that. Mm-hmm. You know, when you go work vintages, you do whatever needs to be done. So at Framingham, that was going out and throat finning at one point, and a lot of berry sampling, especially when I was working overseas. You know, when I was at Premium, the vineyard managers would bring me the samples, but when I was working overseas, I was pretty much the lab gopher, you know. Mm-hmm. So be out doing samples and checking on stuff.
So at what stage did you develop your actual taste, your ability to discriminate the tastes of wine?
That's an ever-evolving skill set. That's one of the things I like about wine. There are masters of wine. It's something that you have to continually work at and continually do. I mean, I started right away in 2003. I remember, I think it was Russell telling me to just go to the grocery store and taste everything. Smell everything, taste everything. And it's as simple as just tasting something and thinking this is the taste of apple, and your brain naturally will start making those associations. So when you start having, you know, Chardonnays and going, oh, this is apple, I get a lot of apple in here, that's where it's coming from. It's your brain just naturally making those associations after you've spent time telling it these are the associations.
And you do that by yourself? It wasn't a class, I mean, it was just like a self-taught thing.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, the wine community is a pretty tight little community, and part of the reason why we do it is because we enjoy wine. So we had lots of tastings, Riesling tastings, Premier Cru tastings, stuff like that. So we'd get together as groups and taste through.
And then did you say this has apple and this doesn't have apple? I mean, what? How do you communicate?
How do we communicate?
I mean, one always sees these pictures, these images
of everybody
swirling around, but you never hear what they're saying to each other.
Right. What we try to do is, because you very much are influenced by what other people say, so we'll go around in a circle and, you know, describe the wine as we see it. And we try to start with a different person every time. But everybody's palate is different. Everybody's tastes are different. Some people are more sensitive to others. Some people have what's called a super palate. They taste more. They have more taste buds. So physically, so the good tastes better, but the bad tastes worse. So it's not necessarily a good thing, it's just it's a more sensitive palate, because it all comes down to chemistry, you know.
How's your palate?
I would hope that it's pretty well developed after this many years in the wine industry, but I do know that my husband naturally has a better palate than I do. Just naturally. Like, it kills me sometimes because he'll just, you know, so in passing, I said to him a couple times, I'm like, you know, you could develop this and, you know, you'd be better than most of the people that I spend time with. And he's like, nope, I want to enjoy wine. I want to enjoy my food. Because I do find myself sometimes, like, just not relaxing and having a glass of wine. I'm sitting there analyzing.
Yeah?
Yeah, what's going on. That's why it's nice to have a beer every once in a while to just enjoy it.
But that's the thing that I would wonder, too. It's not just the taste. You have to have language, too. You know, there might be another word besides apple or whatever.
The most simple, when you first start tasting wine, it's, do you like it or do you not like it? It's as simple as that. That is something you should kind of keep in your mind throughout the entire process. You know, no matter how trained you are, it should still come down to, do you like it or do you not like it? And, you know, who cares what other people say? If you don't like it, you don't like it.
And if you do like it, then you need to know why.
No, if you need to enjoy it. If you're a professional, yeah, maybe you might want to know a little bit more. And if you're a winemaker, you know, you definitely will have the curiosity as to what did they do? Why, you know, why is this preferred?
So do you think that most people are not very well educated about wine? Just, we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but how do you feel about the North Fork wine business? I mean, is it good wine as a region? I mean, you know, I know what they say.
Yeah.
I know what the Wine Council says. I know what everybody says. But in an international or global or whatever context, well, how do you think of Long Island wines?
I think we're there. I think it's just a matter of marketing and just awareness. I mean, I've had some fantastic wines from out here that they're on the level with, you know, $200-$300 bottles of wine.
Really?
But being local, everybody's like, oh, but it's, you know, we're not in Bordeaux, we're here. And it's like, yeah, we are, but we've got, right now, I mean, I'm kind of excited to be in the wine industry at this point in time because we have so much talent out here right now. And we have so many people that have been out here for decades, you know, so they know their vineyards, they know their winemaking facilities, they know their wines. And then we've also got, you know, a couple of transplants like Gilles Martin and Russell Hearn and Roman Roth that...
who've come from Europe.
Europe, Australia, Germany and France, and grew up in winemaking families or grew up around wine. And, you know, they've brought that collective knowledge with them. So we've kind of got this amazing hybrid wine area where, you know, whereas if you're in Alsace, everybody's making wine like they make in Alsace.
Yeah.
Whereas here you've got a German winemaker that's making it the way he wants to make it. But of course they have to adapt because we're not there. We're here on Long Island. Wolfer is a great example of knowing here, you know, Richie Piscano, the vineyard manager, who's also my boss at Roanoke. You know, he grew up out here. He knows these areas. He planted a lot of the vineyards while he was working for Mudd. So he knows those vineyards. He knows this area very well.
He knows the terroir.
Yeah. Roman knows the winemaking skills, and Roman brings with him that collective knowledge of coming from winemaking families. So I think we're very, very lucky to have that, because when you've been to regions where there's sort of, where they've kind of pigeonholed themselves into making a certain style of wine, and that's changing now with my generation coming up into the wine. There's lots of young French winemakers that are making their wines different ways.
Non-traditional.
So, but we've always kind of been, you know, we're New World wine region, so we've always been non-traditional. Everything that we're doing
there
is kind
no
of...
tradition.
There was no tradition. We're creating that tradition right now. We are past the point where we're just trying to grow grapes out here and just have a decent wine. Like, I think pretty much across the board, everybody's making good wine, non-flawed wine. But there are some people that are raising the bar above others. And we also live in a very global world where you can walk down to the wine shop and you can buy very good French wine. I mean, we have... you know, some great local wine shops that you can just go get very, very good quality wine right there. And, you know, having wines available from South America, you can get very good wines for very little money. So, you know, it's a funny game, the wine industry.
Robin Epperson McCarthy is telling us about her life and work as a science graduate, a sommelier, and a winemaker. This is WPKN Radio.
Merlot is the most widely planted red on Long Island. It's one of the most widely planted reds in New York State. Globally, I think it might be the most planted red. So globally, Merlot is planted in very high percentages. So it's a grape that performs well in a lot of different places, but just because you can grow it doesn't mean it's great. Mm. Here, we're making some fantastic wines with Merlot and Merlot-based blends. Mm. You know, the reason why Merlot does well out here is because it's one of the first reds to come in. Pinot Noir comes in first, but Pinot Noir has a hard time on Long Island because it's very thin-skinned. Mm. We're a maritime climate with lots of humidity. Whereas Merlot comes in relatively early, it's not totally immune to the humidity, but it performs better than others. So it does well out here. Everybody's producing a good Merlot. Some people are producing great Merlots. The goal is to bring Merlot from Long Island, which is fantastic and does well every year, and kind of make people aware that this is our grape.
I would like you to talk a little bit more about the sommelier thing. I mean, are you a better chemist than a sommelier?
Probably, yeah, because I'm not a practicing sommelier. I mean, it's something I haven't totally written off, but my husband and I own a house out here. We live out here. There's only a couple of restaurants out here that have an on-staff sommelier, and a few restaurants that have an on-staff sommelier that also ends up being a bartender or a hostess or something else like that. So right now, probably not. And my real passion is the winemaking side of it. So that's why I've, you know, this past vintage started my own wine making. So I'll have a label out this spring.
Yeah, I want you to talk about that. But let me just ask you just to finish about this. So what does it take to be a good sommelier?
Good education, good mentors and peers. There's a lot to know. I mean, the Oxford Companion of Wine is like a 4-inch thick tome of wine. So where to know to focus for something like that. You know, it's probably the equivalent of going on Jeopardy with geography.
But in the end, the sommelier is somebody who's recommending a wine at a table to a guest
right.
in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, I can be easily awed by those people. You know,
yeah.
It's to me, it's suddenly reminded of the taxi drivers in London who have to know every single street
right.
in London.
Yeah.
And so is it like when a sommelier says, oh, this is a good vintage of a whatever and it's got these qualities in the apple. I mean, should one believe them?
Well, most of the restaurants that have on-staff sommeliers are of a certain caliber and prestige and a certain...
The restaurants.
Yes, and a certain price point. I would hope that they've got somebody on staff that really knows this
so
stuff.
So they could know hundreds of wines then, right?
I mean, they have to know hundreds of wines. They have to know all the wines that are on their wine list. Plus, you know, I was doing some consulting for a restaurant and you have to know what's on your restaurant's wine list. You have to know what your distributors have in their portfolio, which most restaurants aren't working with one or two distributors. They're working with quite a few.
Mm.
And now, because we have the internet, you've got people coming into restaurants and wine shops saying, I want this wine. It got 90 points in Spectator. I'd like to have this with my steak. So you now have to figure out which distributor carries this wine, or maybe they don't. And then you have to get in touch with the winery.
Or what is your substitute?
Or what is a substitute? So, yeah, so there is an academic sort of part of it where you could read about wines and, you know, using that language that sommeliers use, have a pretty good idea of what this wine is and maybe substitute that for something else. But most of them have and are actively tasting hundreds of wines.
What is the fun of being a sommelier? What are the gratifications?
When you go to a wine shop, you've got this wall of wine in front of you and you don't even know where to start. Whereas if you've got some wine training or wine knowledge, you can say, okay, I want a really crisp, dry Riesling. So I'm going to veer away maybe from Alsatian Rieslings and go to Finger Lakes Rieslings that have the International Riesling Scale. So you know to like pick up that bottle of Riesling, turn it around, and there's that index on the back that tells you how sweet it is.
Mm.
You know, that's something I try to point out to people all the time, and they're like, oh, this is so useful. And it's like, yeah, well, it's almost, you know, New York State Rieslings, and it's starting to be more and more prevalent.
But you're doing it right now in the winery, in the tasting room.
Yeah, in the tasting room. So in the tasting room, being on Love Lane, I'll have people come in all the time that have bought dinner at the Love Lane Kitchen or dinner at Lombardi's or got cheese down at the Village Cheese Shop, and they'll come in and, especially with the cheese shop, when people come in with that bag, they're looking for a wine, I'll say, are you pairing it with the cheeses? Yes, what kind of cheeses did you get? And if it's something that I've had before, because cheese is a lot like wine and that the more you taste, the more you kind of catalog in your brain what they are, the better you can pair it with wine. So if they come in and say, I got a Hollerhocker, I can be like, okay, try the Wild Sauvignon, the Wild Chardonnay. That might pair perfectly with it. And people do come back. I mean, it's a small community and they're on the lane all the time. So
yeah,
you couldn't really because they would come right back in and tell you.
You've traveled really quite widely.
Right.
As a wine person.
As a wine person and before that.
But do you see yourself as staying here in terms of your career? Staying on the North
Fork? At this point, I hope so. Yeah, I mean, that's why I ended up coming back. I mean, I was out in California. Although, when I was out in California, that was 2009 and the economy just kind of dropped out. So that was the main reason for coming home. But, you know, I kept going away and coming back and taking, you know, things that I'd learned and being like, oh, we could apply that to that. When I did leave Premium Wine Group in 2009, I remember like coming back and feeling almost like homeless because I didn't have a winery to go back and take this knowledge to. So I found myself talking a lot with friends that were also working there. There's a reason why I stayed here. I mean, we bought our house here because I want to be part of this industry. And
it's still growing, isn't it? It's still more and more. I mean, how many vineyards are there officially now?
Somewhere between 40 and 50 on the East End,
And no reason to think that it's going to not keep going.
Well, eventually we're going to run out of land.
Do people talk about any effects of climate change on...
Constantly,
What do they say?
Yeah. The last three vintages out here have all been phenomenal vintages. But the real scary thing about climate change is that it will become unpredictable what's going to happen with storms and, you know, flooding and stuff like that. You see more of the warmer varieties, I think, ripening more consistently every year out here. Because it's already happening. The temperature's already gone up. So you do see historically that the temperature has gone up. And I remember talking to Alice Wise recently about it, and she's saying that the weather patterns are changing. So it's not as straightforward as it's getting warmer, we'll be able to plant like bigger reds that are later ripening. It's the weather patterns are changing.
Unpredictably, you mean?
Unpredictably at this point, yeah.
That's a thing, you know. I always feel sorry for the meteorologists. That's what the change is. It's to unpredictability. Anyway, that's a separate thing. The other thing is, so you didn't really finish talking because I interrupted you about your own label. So you've got the chemical stuff, you've got the sommelier thing, you've got the job in the tasting room.
Yeah, and my main reason, well, the Piscona family is a great family to work for, and Roanoke Vineyards is making some great wines, but I've always loved going into their tasting room. You know, I just like the way that their approach is, they don't get distracted by other things happening, events and whatnot. They've always kept the focus on wine. So I wanted to go work for them because in the past I'd worked for other wineries that did a lot of events and a lot of weddings and stuff like that. And I always was fascinated, like, how Roanoke was able to, one, you know, stay small and keep it focused on wine.
Because it's a family. It's a family business.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Right? Which they aren't all necessarily at all.
Yeah, no, and especially with, you know, Lee becoming part of a investment group.
So that's one thing.
That went from Roanoke, a family-owned winery to being part of an investment group. So that's kind of the natural order of things, you know. Most businesses start out as a family business where, you know, you've got your kids running deliveries or running the cash register or whatever until somebody else comes along and
with the money,
So I'm making for release in hopefully June 2015 if everything goes according to plan and gets approved and bottled. It'll be a stainless steel Sauvignon Blanc, a stainless steel Chardonnay, and a barrel fermented Sauvignon Blanc. And then
Stainless steel, sorry, for those who don't know what we're talking about, which includes me, stainless steel is where it's fermented?
The vessel in which it's fermented. So traditionally wine was fermented in either amphora, which is like a concrete or... wouldn't be concrete, ceramic, sorry. Mm-hmm. Or ceramic eggs or concrete tanks. So a lot of new world wineries, and actually a lot of old world wineries now, are using stainless steel because it's very easy to sanitize. It's non-reactive with wine. It's a slightly more anaerobic environment for making wine, so you preserve a lot of those very fresh, delicate aromatics when you do stainless steel fermentation.
It's not porous, which I think amphoras...
Amphora and concrete and barrels are all porous, get a little bit of micro-wox during the fermentation process.
So two stainless steel... So tell me again what the wines are that you're working
on? Stainless steel Chardonnay, stainless steel Sauvignon Blanc, and then a barrel-fermented Sauvignon Blanc.
So they're all whites...
for this year, and then I've got a Merlot that is fermented and going through that secondary malolactic fermentation that won't be released for another 18 months.
So what does it mean to have your own wine?
Because I've got a long history with Premium Wine Group, I'm producing there. And I did buy one tank. I bought a semi-permeable egg that, for all sorts of reasons, for convection currents within the active ferment, I like the way that they ferment the wine. So I bought one of those for myself. But, you know, Premium's a contract winery, so they have a lot of the equipment in the tanks already. I had to buy my barrels and all my, you know, supplies and stuff like that.
But otherwise you have their lab and you can do it, or you don't. I mean, I'm just curious. Is it just like all you're doing is borrowing their or leasing or whatever their equipment?
For the most part, yeah.
And then you are the only one responsible for it? Or do you other people test it and taste it or whatever the things are?
Yeah, I mean, we look at stuff like the Brix, which is the measurement of sugar. We'll look at that every day. So
we is who?
The winemaking team, of which I would be considered the winemaker for this wine. So, I mean, during the last few months over the fall, I was literally going to Premium Wine Group for a couple of hours in the morning, changing in the bathroom there, going to the tasting room, selling wine for the next 8 hours, going back to the winery to do whatever else needed to get done for the night, and then go home, do the eat, sleep, shower, repeat routine. I mean, they were there if I wasn't able to make it there to do, like, punch downs, which is with the red wine. That's where we just simply push the skins back down into the fermenting liquid so that
you
get
that
color extraction. Yeah, somebody was there to do it. So it's nice in that respect. And because I know the team and know the equipment, there were a couple times where I just did stuff myself, but
it's your responsibility.
Oh,
it's
absolutely.
Your thing.
Yeah. Well, anybody that produces there has a winemaker that is responsible for what is going on.
Oh, because other people produce there too.
Mm-hmm. So that's where they've got a really, really good team over there. They've got the cellar crew. And at any winery, you have a trained cellar crew. So at Premium, they've got a trained cellar crew and they've got some fabulous equipment.
So is it like outsourcing in a way, or is it not like that?
No, because you have to be a lot more hands-on. Mm-hmm. I mean, outsourcing, I would kind of imagine sending grapes off to some facility and just getting wine back.
But the grapes, do you have to choose the grapes?
Yeah, that was kind of the big unknown because, you know, I don't have a vineyard. So I work as what's called a négociant, where I'm working with vineyards to source the best fruit that is available.
My last question is, you know, so you basically grew up here on the North Fork.
Right, yep.
And now as a resident and as obviously somebody committed to living here, how do you feel about the North Fork and development or lack of development?
It's a very slippery slope, isn't it? Mm. It's finding that balance between having to have a growing population be able to live and work and make a sustainable living and trying to keep it just like it was. Because it's never going to stay just like it was. There's no way to, like, crystallize it in time.
Yeah.
So it's just finding the balance that benefits everybody. The more people that come and live out here, the more customers you have for your business. But, you know, in the wine industry, the more houses that are built, the less land that we can potentially put vineyards on. So that's going to be the bottleneck for the wine industry out here, is going to be when there is a demand for the wine. We are gaining prestige. There will be more of a demand for it.
But there won't be enough land.
But there won't be more land to plant. Whereas in California, once Napa and Sonoma and these amazing wines were coming out, they could spread into the Central Valley, which, you know, the Central Valley had been dedicated to fruit. Now, well, grapes are a fruit, but 2009, there were about 250 wineries. Now I think there's 350, 400 wineries. And in 2009, the reason why the economy dropped out was because they ran out of water. They'd gone through the first two water tables, and now they have even more wineries.
And less water.
And less water, yeah. Like anywhere in the world, we have to look at what's sustainable for our environment, our way of life, being able to, you know, be born and raised on Long Island and be able to afford a house. You know, I just bought a house. To buy what would be our one and only permanent home, we were competing with Manhattan salaries for what would be their second home for the same price range. Mm. Sustainability is probably going to be the defining word of my current generation, just trying to find a way to balance it all out.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Great
to find out all this stuff about you.
Yes, and now I've had my first radio interview. It's exciting.
Thank you.
That was Robin Epperson McCarthy talking about why she's chosen a life in the North Fork's wine growing business. You can hear North Fork Works on the first Wednesday of each month at 7:30 p.m. All North Fork Works programs broadcast on WPKN are archived at hazelkahn.com and produced by Tony Ernst.